A little bit of, by way of review from last week, because I think it's an important lead-in to where I'd like to try to go tonight in the talk. Last week we talked about bodhicitta, and the word bodhicitta has a lot of different meanings, and basically, to keep it simple, the word bodhi means awakened or awakening, and the word citta means mind. So together that means awakened or awakening mind. And the word mind here is being used not as we typically associate to it as the thinking process, the intellectual process. But mind in this sense is the nature of being. It's the nature of what we are. And so what I talked about is how there are basically two views that humans can have once they're even aware of the possibility that they can be free, which means that you become aware that there is suffering and that there is unhappiness and that there is loss and that there is difficulties in life. Once you actually recognize that, and some people really don't let themselves even come intimate to that fact, you wouldn't be even open to the possibility that you could be free from suffering if you don't even consider that you are suffering. Okay. So the first noble truth, the fact that there is suffering in life, is a wake-up call. Now, once there's an understanding that there's a possibility for freedom or emancipation or an easing of that which ails you, then the view that what is happening, particularly if what is happening is difficult, can arise. And that view may be that what is happening, if it's difficult, is actually in the way of being awake or being free. That somehow that which is there, whatever it might be, a fear, an anger, a distress of some kind, that that is actually in the way. That what I actually am in my essence is something other than this that is in my way. And so this somehow then would have to be removed. There's a lot of different kinds of views that people can have that feed into this. There's different kinds of therapies that actually promote the idea that you're going to remove this, that this is an impediment. Even the word hindrance is sometimes used in classic Buddhist teachings. And to us, for many of us at least, the word hindrance means it's something that is in the way. So this is a very popular view at times. That which is happening, if it's unsatisfactory, is in the way. Must be removed. A little bit of a, you might say, more liberated or lighter view is that that which is happening, if it's difficult, is actually part of the nature of what I am. Okay, it's not a foe. It's a friend in disguise. And that it is by nature transforming. In this, we can have words like this which is happening, if it's difficult, is fertilizer or manure, as the teachings sometimes say, manure for bodhi. That's absolutely essential to experience that which is difficult, to realize that which is free from difficulty. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And then there's another, it's not really a view, but it's the true understanding. It's the true, you might say, realization. And that is that everything that is happening is bodhi. Okay, there isn't anything happening inwardly, outwardly, in any way whatsoever, in any moment of time, that isn't the awakened nature. Now, what that means is that what you personally, as you experience yourself personally, could be experiencing at times is a confusion of this, that your states of mind, that which is unsatisfactory to you, is confused, and that is why you would not perceive what is happening as the awakened nature. So what that does is it thrusts you back, that confusion, it thrusts you back into one of the previous views, which is this is in the way, it's got to get out of the way, or a little bit lighter than that, what's happening is the fuel, it's the petrol, it's the manure, it's the fertilizer for waking up. Okay, so you can see why, as human beings, we experience ourselves as limited. We experience ourselves as restricted. We experience ourselves as separate. Now, this is predicated on something, isn't it? It's predicated on the personality belief. The investment in yourself as a personality. Just notice this. How common and, you might say, agreed upon this view is. Now, if you contemplate the teachings of no self in Buddhism, which you cannot understand this with your mind because your mind is part of the view that you are a self. So you can actually think your way through this. In fact, your thinking, most of our thinking, right, is an expression, ultimately, of the awakened nature. Okay, but it appears to be unawakened. It appears to be in the way of the awakened nature. And the thinking that we have upholds our view. What does our thinking tell us? Our thinking tells us that I am a personality. I am an individual. And more significant than just that, I am separate. Okay, just notice that in the room right now. The view that you are sitting, wherever you're sitting, and that others are sitting someplace else. Okay, that's a perception. And then to add to that, that I am a personality. I have certain traits, I have certain attitudes. Information, reading information or hearing information, in most cases, will not change those views that I am a personality and that I am separate. The only thing that liberates beings, and we're human beings, the only thing that liberates beings is seeing clearly the truth. And these realizations or insights are not thoughts. Realization or insight can affect thinking. One could have thoughts about a realization. I'm not saying that only meditation practice can bring clear seeing or insight. What brings clear seeing or insight is a fertile ground, just like what brings a flower or a vegetable is a fertile ground. What actually brings a universe? What brings everything is a fertile ground. An environment, you could say, that allows that. It's like the womb is a fertile ground for the fetus to grow within. If I want my baked sweet potato, I need a fertile ground like my oven. And so it goes. We can get very caught in our thinking about any number of things, but what I want to focus on is the way we can get caught in our thinking, and we can confuse our thinking about ourselves with what we actually are. This is what most human beings are experiencing. There's a confusion. When I mean confusion, I mean fused together. What I think I am is confused or fused together with what I actually am. So what spiritual practice, meditation, and inquiry can do is it can bring a space, an inner space, it begins as that, an inner space to begin to see clearly that what I think I am is confused with what I actually am. And what I actually am appears from something that is beyond thought. That's what insight is. It is beyond thought. Realization, true seeing, is beyond thought. Now, as quickly as an insight may arise, there may be thoughts about that. Many human beings have this experience. So what we're doing when we meditate is we're actually allowing the cultivation of a fertile ground so that clear seeing or insight can occur. This is the only thing that liberates beings. This is the only thing that can truly free us. And if we are in a space like this, a talk is being given, and some insight arises, okay, it is not arising primarily because the talk is being given. That, you might say, is a small contribution. The reason why insight is arising is because of merit. Is because you deserve to be free. It's an interesting way to consider the word merit. Merit means to deserve. It also means value, worth, excellence. Okay. So I'm going to begin to lead into this as the topic of the talk, but I just want to give some sort of preliminary pieces that help tie together why merit is so important. So we believe in the personality view. We think it's real. And what no self or anatta, as it's described in Buddhist teachings, the word anatta means no self, really means is that the idea that you are a separate personality, the belief, the personality belief idea, never, okay, the fact of the personality never actually existed as we think it does. So what the realization of anatta is it's the penetration through the veil or the illusion of being a separate personality. If I believe that I'm a separate personality, if I believe that I'm a separate individual, inevitably I will and do experience that I am separate from other things. I might at a certain point long in my heart to be unified, to not feel separate, to not feel separate within myself, because it's not just that we can feel separate from that which is around the body, we can feel separate within ourselves. There can be parts of what's inside of this that are in conflict with other parts. It doesn't feel homogeneous. It doesn't feel integrated. It doesn't feel harmonious. Even our thinking process can sometimes feel very, very disjointed. Our liking and disliking can feel just disjointed. Certain feelings can feel disjointed from other feelings. And one of the classics, very classic one, us Westerners are particularly vulnerable to this. We can feel fragmented between our thinking and our feeling. We're so fragmented at times between our thinking and our feeling that it is our heart that gets obscured by our mind, our thinking mind. Our thinking mind rules our heart. This is a person who's lost touch with what it feels like to be a human being. Or their feelings, and this is also the case sometimes, their feelings are not feelings of joy and happiness. Their feelings are feelings of stress, discomfort, depression, uneasiness. And no wonder they would escape to their head if that's what they're going to feel if they go down inside. No wonder they would go up and abstract their experience, think about things, distract themselves, stay out of their feelings if those feelings are painful. But what the practice is about, and what all therapies must do in some way and support, whether it's a body therapy or a mind therapy or some combination of the two, is a reversal of this so that it's not the head that rules the heart, but it's the heart that rules the head. It's the heart of the human. It guides the head. It's the feeling of compassion and kinship and vulnerability and transiency. Yes, this is all transient. It's the feeling of kinship in that that births the ethos of compassion, love, wisdom, and all forms of happiness. The absence of that ethos of compassion, of the realization of kinship in the heart, fragments the human being within him or herself and fragments that human being from the nature of that kinship which we are intimately, never not a part of, even when we feel utterly and totally alone. Because again, as I said at the beginning of the talk, that acute aloneness is bodhicitta. It is the awakened nature. But it is confused. So it would be very simple in a way if the view, the view, and it is the view that we cherish and hold that's generated often by our thinking, and at times by experiences, and sometimes experiences that we have that are very challenging or difficult, painful, will also condition the view. Experiences of loss, experiences of hardship, experiences of being misunderstood, experiences of feeling alienated will condition our thinking. If we could read text, spiritual text, if we could just listen to talks, and that would penetrate and clarify that distorted view, it would be so much easier. But it often doesn't work that way. Awareness has to penetrate inwardly to that place where the view is held. And we can't easily just find that by, close our eyes, look around. Where am I holding the view? Whatever that view might be. Where am I holding that view? Can't put my finger on it. And yet it can be found when we investigate. So we need the skill of investigation. We need the skill of concentration. We need the skill of mindfulness. We need the courage and the commitment to look. Because if we're not willing to look at what ails us, how can we possibly expect that we'll get out of what ails us? How can we overcome it? Just by luck? You can't buy your way out. Someone who's very rich has no greater chance at being free than someone who has no riches. That is a certain kind of merit to have riches. But look at the complications that come with those at times who are very wealthy. I mean, it's not to say there aren't complications for those who have very little. One of the merits and resources of the people of Haiti, and it's been talked about now for days, is not so much the natural resource, it's not so much that it's a beautiful island that could attract tourism again when they get it together, it's the spirit of the people. So we're actually sitting in this room tonight. We are in these bodies, so to speak. We are on planet Earth because of merit. This is gift. It's a priceless gift, and it's so easily taken for granted that you're a human being. We lose touch with what it's actually like to be a human being, to have the gift of a precious human life. And guess what? It's possible this is the only one. Now, in Buddhist teachings, let's be very clear about the difference between something that's experiential that's being said here and something that's theoretical. In Buddhist teachings, there's a multiplicity of lives. And the New Age thinking has said, what's going to happen is if you don't get it together to really see what you are in this life, you're going to get another chance. So people go, phew. Especially when they screw up, phew, I'm going to get another chance. Haven't really seen the nature of karma. Haven't seen how cause and effect works, but take on a belief system. There's another belief system. This is the one and only life. When you die, it's a complete blank. Boom. like deep sleep, no consciousness, no additional life, no bardo. Okay, bardo means transitional zone. No bardo. It's just boom. That's another belief system. Anybody who believes that doesn't know what they're talking about. Unless they've experienced that, which means they had to die before, which means they had a previous life, doesn't it? What was interesting, if you look at the teachings of the Buddha, he described all of his past lives in detail. I mean, just a whole bunch of them. He said the whole thing opened up. We're going to say, now that's just a metaphor. He's not really talking about actuality. If your mind wants to hold a belief, you know what? It's going to try to do it. And a belief isn't just a thought. A belief is a crystallized thought form that actually gets down into, not just the brain tissue, gets down into the nervous system, gets down into the body. It becomes embodied. That's what a belief system is. How about the belief that you're not free? How about the belief that you're free? Neither of those have anything whatsoever to do with freedom. So be careful as I go on to watch how the mind might begin to believe in certain things about merit. This is not about replacing one belief system with another. Shining up a new belief system, putting it over the other one, or getting rid of one belief and now insert another one. This is not about beliefs. The nature of spiritual practice, the only thing that frees beings from the shackles of their own delusion and illusions, is insight, is seeing the truth for yourself. And it just so happens that practicing meditation is one of the most merit-cultivating activities a human being can engage in. Number one, it's very difficult to be hurting and messing up anybody else's life when you're meditating. Have you noticed that? You have your mouth closed. Sometimes you have your eyes closed. You're not doing anything with your hands. Okay? It's very difficult to mess anybody else up when you're meditating. Although you could be messing yourself up if you didn't know what you were doing. If you were not actually able to attend to what's occurring and know how to attend to that, such that that which is occurring begins to reveal what the name of the game really is. What is the name of the game? The name of the game is that everything that's happening has the merit already within it. It has the gift, the excellence, the value, the worth already within it to wake you up. It's not going to become that. It already is that. But again, here's the confusion and the misunderstanding that would suggest, well, no, that doesn't really seem true to me. My experience suggests otherwise. My experience suggests to me that certain things that happen in the human realm have more merit than others. And you can find reason to believe that in how the mind will interpret the scriptures. Like feeding a monk has more merit than feeding a householder. Experiencing the debt of gratitude and repaying that debt to your parents for bringing you here has more merit than being nice to your sister or your brother. So you can see how even in the scriptures there can be the sense of duality in the language. Relative perception is dualistic. Relative perception says This is over here, that is over there. Relative perception says this is better than that. This has more merit than that. This has less merit. Relative perceptions would say this is the way to live that's more skillful, and this is the way to live that is less skillful. And if that's your experience, that there is a higher, lower, better, worse, you got to go with it until you know something else. You can't go with something other than what you actually are experiencing, unless you're just going to try to believe a belief, and that won't work. It'll just make you more confused. Try to believe a better belief. Like, for example, some people believe that what they should be is loving all the time. They hear about compassion, loving kindness, and they believe they should be loving all the time. And then they experience themselves as not loving, and then they get into conflict, and they get into judgment, and they get into guilt, and they get into even shame, because they haven't lived up to their ideal. That's not what the teachings are saying. The teachings aren't saying you should be loving, you should be unattached. There's nowhere in there that really says that, although the mind will sometimes hear that. And sometimes teachers will say that, don't be attached. Right. When do I start? How do you do that? It's confused. So, once you begin to feel, and the feeling is very important, not think, feel, sense, that it's a gift to be a human being. It's not a gift that makes you better than a tree. But you sense there's something going on here. There's some potentiality going on here that distinguishes me from a tree. You realize when you watch a dog who has an itch and goes at it, to the point where it's irritated, that you, when you have an itch, have the capacity to not be so extreme. And you have medicine. It's called the merit of medicine. A lot of people right now are cultivating, accumulating all kinds of merit by serving in Haiti without any compensation monetarily. And it's going to go on for a long time. There's some people whose lives are completely involved in service, and they take no money. And they're not monks, and they're not nuns. See, because a monk or nun, a renunciate by essence, takes no payment. They hold no money. They have no personal belongings. But they sometimes, I've been told, get very attached to their eating bowls. Because if you only have a few things, a bowl, a robe, some sandals, if there's attachment potential in your mind, it's probably going to go towards those things. That's the point of getting simple. If you're going to go down the path of renunciation, it isn't to, you know, deprive yourself. It's to realize that you have this potentiality in your mind to fixate and attach to things that aren't yours. But still, the mind does it, doesn't it? The most powerful thing that the mind does that with is this. This is mine. And you know what? It's not. You know why it's not? Because there is no mine. M-I-N-E, there is no mine. This can't be mine because there is no mine. The idea that this is mine, or that is yours, that's the illusion. That the merit of insight, yeah, the excellent, the worth, the value, the deserving nature of insight helps reveal. And generally, just to keep it simple, what happens is there's just a letting go. If there's a holding, it softens. This doesn't really change that much when it's realized this isn't yours. Except that it becomes, in a way, you could say healthier or more fluid, and it's still going to get sick, and it's still going to stop breathing, and it's still going to stop. That doesn't change. What changes is the fixation upon this as mine. Now, some people have a hard time with this because they say, well, wait a minute, that sounds kind of depersonalizing, impersonal. That sounds kind of negative, pejorative. Okay, let's play with that a little bit. Because even though this isn't mine, this is a part of what I am. But so is everything else. And if this is held as mine, then it's very, very quick that the mind will say, that's not mine. In Buddhist teachings, it's said that what your life is about is the realization of the merit that you have been given. And if your life is going to become all that it can be, what you need to do is re-engage or reactivate or recharge the merit that you've already been given. Let me give an example of this. Because sometimes people will be exposed to possibilities and they will connect to those possibilities, maybe even very strongly, and then they will turn away. Have you ever seen this happen? You ever seen that you yourself stop yourself from realizing a deeper connection with that which you know is wholesome? It happens in meditation sometimes. People will actually begin to really see these things in their meditation, and then something will come up. It could be in their so-called outer life, in their relationships. Something will come up internally, they'll get afraid, and they'll turn away. I met a guy, he meditated intensively for a period of time. A lot of very powerful things happened. He went away for 10 years. He stopped meditating for 10 years. I didn't ask him what actually happened, you know, what he was doing with that time. I caught up with him when he was just coming back. And he made it very clear with very few words that he didn't need to nor want to talk about where he had been. Go down a blind alley. If you've been inside a prison, and you can just take minimum security, never mind maximum security, if you go inside a prison and you hang out in the energetic of what many of those prisoners are living in, the mindsets and states they're living in, you can feel the weight of the accumulation of the actions of the past. That's why a lot of people don't even want to go near that. That's why there's a big, thick wall. It's not just because those people might be dangerous and might harm us, steal from us, kill us. But the weight of the accumulated actions is palpable. That's called karma. The pressure, the tension, the weight that we sometimes feel, wherever it feels burdened in this frame, at any moment, a little or a lot, is karma. So what we begin to have a chance to do is we begin to see that our actions are extremely powerful. That our actions have consequences. They are not in a bubble. They're not in a vacuum. That when we act with generosity, we act with kindness, we act with compassion, we act with love, we act with respect, it has an impact, it has an influence, not only on everything around the body, but a direct influence on the body. We act with anger, we act from fear, jealousy, aversion, confusion, act from any of these afflictive mind states, and if you look closely, you see the result. And you can see it like that. It's faster than that. affects the sensorial experience immediately. Now, let's go a little deeper with that. If it makes sense that your actions have consequences, and that if happiness and freedom for yourselves and others is important to you, that your actions have an impact on that possibility, then you begin to contemplate that the motivation for the action is actually more important than the action. The motivation. The energy in your mind that precedes anything that you do. Because, as I've been trying to emphasize, as much as we may think we're really clear about the way things are, much of the time the human mind, for many, is confused. We're still fairly functional. We can have jobs and we can be relatively nice. But as it was illustrated to me today with a particular person, she made it very clear that if she slows down and she actually goes inside and she stops being outwardly active, she experiences conflict. How about you? When you really stop, when you really look inside, what do you see? What you're seeing is what's happening in the present moment, and what's happening in the present moment is an accumulation, a countless number of contributions, like a gigantic, ever-widening funnel out the back behind you. This is just a metaphor. That contributes to what's happening right now. And what's happening right now. And what's happening right now. So if you see that you have been given things in your life, that people were good to you, that they treated you well, they treated you with kindness, with generosity. They helped you. You're experiencing yourself within the field of that giver's or that guide or that friend or that parent's merit. Our merit is actually a field. Just like our consciousness is a field. Merit is a field. It's a field that has no boundary. What's actually going on in this world is human beings interacting with one another through the field of their respective merits. And this is just talking about those things that really support the wholesome, the happiness, the welfare, the well-being. Mixed into that field of merit, right, are all the various forms of confusions and delusions, aggressions, fears, attachments, etc. It's mixed together. But as you begin to look at your direct experience, that's the only way to see these things, is you have to look at your direct experience. Meditation is the primal tool for that. You can begin to discern that which is clear from that which is confused. You actually begin to understand what the Buddha meant when he said there is wholesome actions, wholesome intention, and unwholesome actions, unwholesome intention. So this is a story from one of the Buddha's past lives. He was a captain on a ship. And a pirate came on the ship. And the pirate was armed, I guess, and powerful, and wanted to kill everybody on the ship. Okay. Now, you might think what the Buddha did was he gave his life, you know, he got in there in such a way so that the pirate killed him, and thus he saved the lives of all of the other people on the boat. It's not what happened. What the Buddha did, as the story goes, is he killed the pirate so that the pirate wouldn't kill all the other people. And as the story goes, he accumulated a huge amount of merit through an act that you would think would be the opposite of merit, wouldn't you? How could we do more harm than to kill another being? But in the context of the story, he kills another being so that that being will not kill many others. What would you do if it was that nitty-gritty? We don't know, do we? We don't know what we would do. We don't even know what we would feel. Just like we have no idea what it's going to feel like to die. The only way you can really get close to that is you get close to somebody who's dying. You hold their hand, you look in their eyes, you watch, and then you can actually feel. For those who get close like that, and many do this as a profession in the world of hospice, elder care, make your hair stand on end, because you're going to touch directly the mystery. You're going to touch, if you're open, that which is utterly and totally and always was beyond duality. Thank goodness you don't have to die yourself or be with someone who's dying to see beyond duality. Something's happening right now in this room that is within karma and beyond karma at the same time. The Dharma doesn't just describe the world of duality, the world of relativity, the world of karma. The Dharma is also non-dual truth. All of this, everything, no exception, is bodhicitta. The Dharma describes that. But again, information, even if it's very, very refined information, in most cases does not liberate beings. It's the practice itself that liberates beings. It's clear seeing itself. So, at times we feel the hardship of actually looking at ourselves. We'd rather not look at ourselves. We'd rather just have some fun and distract ourselves. And we're free to do that, have you noticed? If you have the means, you can go out and you can completely indulge your senses and you can keep it going for a bunch of days, months, years. At some point, you may be fortunate. The merit of clear seeing may arise and you'll see that you just took yourself down a blind alley. That you tried to make yourself happy through accumulation, through a sensory happiness. There's nothing wrong with sensory happiness, but if you make that your queen or your king, then you will not begin to see the happiness that comes from actually serving other people and helping them in any way that you can. That's how, in part, you renew and recharge your merit. In any way that you can, you dedicate at least part of your life to helping other beings. You give freely. Now, if you put in there that you have to do this, a belief that this is the, you know, I must do this, and then you start evaluating how much of your giving is enough, and you're just playing mind games. If you look at how children give when they're not caught in selfishness, when they're not caught in I, me, mine, they just go, phew, and they're immediately joyful to give that thing that they give because there's no self for a second. We're capable of that. We don't have to meditate to find a generosity that has no expectation. But we need to learn to be sensitive to when it arises, because we could avoid it, we could distract from it. It could come as a very subtle energy that comes through and begins to be an intention, because nothing happens in the realm of action without intention. Doesn't mean you're always aware of your intentions. This hand doesn't move without intention. This voice doesn't speak without intention. It doesn't mean you're sensitive to those intentions. But what meditation does is it helps you get quiet enough, have enough relaxation and openness to actually see the energy in here that precedes any action that you take. When you first start to see this, you can get confused and think that you are in charge through being able to see your intentions, because you begin to get confused and think that liberation is based on the power of choice. It's not at all. The ability to choose certain things is a tiny little thing called volition that happens in the vastness of bodhicitta, in the vastness of freedom, which is unbounded. So the idea that you can choose and therefore fundamentally make your life better is a complete myth. You can choose something over something else, or so it appears in your mind, and have a different experience and feel better for a while. And in the differentiation between skillful and unskillful actions, it would make sense to know the difference and be able to choose actions that are skillful, that are going to be better for you, better for others. But what I am saying right now is that that's really just moving furniture around in the house to a better position. So it seems to you. Does that mean you're not making any difference at all? No, relatively you're making a difference. But it's not what the nature of awakening really is. A nature of awakening is jumping out of the house altogether and yet still being part of the house. It's not about making things be different. It's not about being able to choose now certain experiences and think that those experiences are making you free. That's a little bit confusing. Could you feel that, potentially? Okay. Not always, but sometimes. That point right there is a little bit confusing because we are very attached to the idea that we can choose and therefore make our life better. Let me be very clear about this. That's an appearance. Okay. There's intention or volition that precedes action. To that we ascribe the language choice. Behind that there's a view that I am doing this action or choice. If we actually look in there, we can't find that I that does that. That's one thing. The other thing is, if we actually investigate what we mean by choice, it's going to break down and we're not going to be able to actually pin it down and say that's a choice. But we've been calling, oh, I did this on Thursday and I did that on Saturday. I made the choice. That's what we think. That's unawakened thinking. That's confused thinking. But notice how popular it is. Notice how often we hear language that supports our ideation, power of choice. Look at your choices, make good choices. Oh, that was a bad choice. You made a bad choice. I mean, can you imagine making a so-called bad choice that breaks the human laws, and then you end up in front of the judge? And the judge says, you did this, you did this, you did this, you did this, you did this. You made some really bad choices. I got to put you in prison for life. No parole. There was a monk who was a colleague of Thich Nhat Hanh's. Don't remember his name. As Thich Nhat Hanh was kicked out of Vietnam, and he was kicked out, and he can't go back still, although they let him go back and visit, but it's not cleared up yet. He was kicked out because he was too peaceful. He had a colleague who was also a monk from Navest. That means you start when you're very, very young. And this monk had a different path, as everyone does. This monk left Vietnam, became a teacher, and was teaching in the Hawaiian Islands. And he had many students. During the course of his teaching career, for reasons that maybe no one will ever understand, except perhaps him if he gets it worked out, he violated the boundaries of some of his students. He slept with some of his young female students. And they, after a period of time, it's very difficult to resolve that if that kind of thing happens to you. If your spiritual teacher, a person who you might trust more than any person you ever trusted in the world, more trustworthy to you than your parents, or your grandparents if they were trustworthy, violates you, and you don't have to be a woman, it can happen to men too, violated, manipulated, it's very difficult to get out of that and expose that. Sometimes it takes years. Anyways, these students, and there were a number of them, they came out finally. And they came to the authorities and they spoke about what happened. And this teacher was brought to trial. And the sentence was, I'm not exactly clear, but it was something in the range of 40, 45-year sentence. He's still in. What is he doing in the prison? Because you get a lot of time to look at your mind if you want to when you're in prison. He's teaching the Dharma. He's teaching what he was teaching before. So you might say his merit was blossoming. That something happened. He lost control. He got confused. He was isolated to begin with. He was conflicted about being a monk. He was a horny celibate. We'll never know. But his life, in a certain sense, relatively speaking, took a major turn, you might say, for the worse. Notice the judgment in our mind. I'm not condoning any violence right now. I'm just saying we are very biased. We know very little about what it means to be equanimous in the midst of the strongest fires, even inside our own mind. The Buddha needed the help of the earth. You may know the story when he touched the earth as his witness in the heart of the most difficult part of his meditation before he awakened. He touched the earth and he called on the earth as his witness and confirmed his right to sit through the confusion, through the stress, through the difficulty and break free. He touched the earth. You can read about this. The whole mudra that goes with it, the way he positioned his hand, it's quite an interesting story. So I need to conclude. This is going to probably turn into a two-part talk, but the merit of insight, the merit of actual truth seen clearly, is how you help yourself and other beings most. You can give money, you can give time. You can give materialities. These are all good. But the way that you help other beings and yourself the most is you do whatever you can to get free of anything and everything that binds you. That's how you serve. That's how you rededicate your merit. That's how you realize what happiness really is. It's not a theory. It's not an ideation. It's not a belief system. It's a direct and real potential. We could say we're here for many different reasons. But once you see this that I'm describing right now, you see this aspect of the Dharma. It's what the Buddha meant in his last teaching when he said, take no external refuge. Take the truth itself as your refuge. What I'm talking about now is that merit itself and understanding the core essence of it is the ultimate, the penultimate refuge. It's the penultimate safety. Because it's not conditioned. It's not limited by any conditions. It's actually how you lift, you might say, or rise out of conditionality. And the interesting, you might say, caveat in there is that those actions, like meditation, that awaken insight, simultaneously release you, so to speak, from egoic grasping, clinging, and fixing upon things as yours. So in a way, the true okayness of being, the true wellness of being, is when there's no holding. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing that need be claimed as yours. And then, as Longchenpa said, you are the eyes of the world at that point. So let me stop here and see what the responses may be, questions about it.